Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hey, Jay, where are you at?
Hey, I'm sitting at my kitchen table. Where are you at?
I'm here in New Orleans. Of course, that's this little expression we have here. It kind of means, how are you doing?
Oh, yeah. I think you've mentioned that before.
Yeah,
I'm kind of forgetting.
I thought it might be nice to have a nightcap and talk a little bit. I'm on my cell phone, of course. You're on your cell phone. And I just noticed on my cell phone, there's a little feature on the menu says enhanced call audio. And I noticed when we've had these conversations in the past that your audio sounds much better than mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd try this. I have no idea what it does. So hold on to your hat.
All right, let's see what happens here. This could be exciting. Jaw-dropping, in fact. Boy, the thrills just keep on coming.
Now it's giving me the choice of normal, boost bass, or boost treble. Do you feel like what do you think I need?
Well, gosh, now that's a good question, because it's mostly like reduced distortion of consonants. Is that one of the options?
Reduced distortion of consonants? Are you saying my consonants are distorted?
Yeah. Like your S's sound more like SH's and such.
Sounds like compression, some kind of compression algorithm at work, or some, who knows, but I have no idea if it's an algorithm or something, just a hardware limitation. But come on, do you want a little more treble or a little more bass?
I'd say a little more bass would be dandy.
Really?
Sure, okay, well, yeah.
Here goes.
Yeah, it kind of make you more booming and... just a second.
All right, I boosted the bass. How do I sound now?
Wow, you sound very deep.
Yeah, I'm sure I do. I was just kidding. I did choose boost bass, so it'll be interesting to see on playback if it makes any difference. I am having a drink. What about you?
Well, you know, I'm not, and it's kind of an unfortunate reason. I actually still have work to do tonight.
So that's what I enjoy it the most.
Really? Yeah, you know, I do too, except I tried to have a drink last night and work on this stuff, and it just...
You're a writer, and writers never drink and write.
Right, exactly.
I, of course, am off of work and just kicking back and enjoying a Cuba Libre, which I'm sure you remember from way back in the day and from our third or was it fifth episode?
That was an early one.
Yeah. And I've loved the drink ever since. And this one's extra special because I put a little of the light rum and a little of the dark rum in there together. So they're kind of intermingling. So it's kind of a racial harmony drink.
Exactly. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Nice.
Well, I just had a glass of baking soda water.
Wow, that is really festive, dude.
Yeah.
Truly. Truly festive. So you're just writing like a madman.
Well, yeah. I mean... Okay, so the great irony of my position as it stands right now is that I just got back from Texas on Saturday night, as you may have discussed in your conversation with Moonboy when I was...
We had a special guest last time in your absence, and that was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I haven't heard from him in years, so... but anyway, I got back on Saturday, but my wife, Day, and my son, Jules, stayed in Texas and are driving back here with my mother, who's going to be here for most of the summer, or some portion thereof. And so, this is before I left Texas. Day, God bless her soul, exhorted me to make sure that while I have this time to myself, I do the things that, will make me happy and get me relaxed and, things that I don't normally have time to do when, she's in school and Julian is around and that kind of thing. Just to generally have a good time. And in her absence, I've worked every night and every day. Sunday I had the whole day to myself, and so I spent it mowing the lawn and generally cleaning up. So I'm kind of officially like a middle class boring guy at this point, it seems.
Yeah. Boy, I thought you were going to talk about how you like scored some acid and started a new rock band, and we're just really freaking out.
You know, I wish that it were true. But no. It's just amazing how these things kind of life seems to get in the way of that. Or not life, but other aspects of things.
Yes, that other aspect. Well, yeah. I can relate somewhat to what you were saying.
And you know, so tonight was sort of my one unscheduled night, except that I had a dinner meeting with a guy who's opening or kind of taking over management of a theater. And now I have this freelance project that I have to get done by next week, and it's a good amount of work. So I'll probably be working on that until they get back.
Well, if it's any consolation, Jay, I've been working tonight too. I went to a little cocktail party on the bayou, by St. John, that's near where we live here, and we had mint juleps. In you know, authentic mint juleps made the right way. Again, another drink that we featured once upon a time years ago.
Yeah.
And when you made them on the show, and you really, it was one of the few times where you really kind of knocked yourself out to actually make a drink the right way. That was very impressive to me, and I realized, wow, this is really a hell of a drink.
Yeah.
Tonight we had them. I mean, the only thing I could say is that they were even better in a way because we're so much further south. And of course, it is a southern drink. So we had them in the silver cups, or I don't know if they were silver, pewter, or whatever they're made of, but with little cloths, little hand cloths, so that your hand didn't get too.
Because pewter sweats.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sweating like a mug. And we're sitting out on the bayou, and you know, talking about stuff. So it is indeed a tough life here. But, I want you to know that you're not the only person who's working tonight, because that was, I was doing that for this nonprofit group that I am president of, Friends of the Deep Corridor.
Yes.
We are gearing up for our fifth annual hike Saturday. Morning.
Yeah.
And I almost feel at this point it's taken on the aura of a magical ritual. That if enough people come out every year and hike this 3-mile length right through the heart of New Orleans, this corridor right through the heart of this urban area, that we will transform it eventually. It's something really cool and really nice and really green, something that kind of knits these neighborhoods together as opposed to being a kind of vacant, in some places kind of an eyesore, just dividing one place from another. It actually be something that connects people to one another. So that looks like it's underway. After 5 years, you're actually starting to see some progress. It just really takes some stick-to-itiveness to actually see those results. But the state of Louisiana recently allocated $2.6 million to the project for the planning and some construction dollars, I expect. And so I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I'm so excited that I popped the zipper pull off my pants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there'll be a lot of that going on Saturday morning, I can guarantee it.
Yeah, exactly. I actually did that, although not out of any form of excitement. But anyway,
I should note that a Cuba Libre is really not a great nightcap because, you know, it's caffeinated.
Yeah.
And so it's really more of like a keep the party going kind of drink rather than a nightcap.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you can keep your party going for a long time, and I can figure out how to zip up my pants.
Although I've got to say that I really feel like summer has begun because, well, traditionally, some people think of summer as beginning at Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it seemed to me like it was a week later. Because 1 week later after Memorial Day, that was when Christy was done with school, completely done. Not only classes done, but teachers don't have to come in anymore. And, you know, now she's staying home with the girl, the daughter, taking her out of daycare for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, you know, that shifting of gears. And all of a sudden, everything is really different about my daily routine. I went off of coffee. I completely got off of the caffeine for a week there. And now I'm back on iced tea, which I apparently am making super strong. Because it is a trip. So I feel like summer is here. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. This last week being in Austin, Texas, of course, it wasn't blazing hot, but it was pretty darn hot and fairly humid down there.
Austin, Texas was always hot.
Yeah, well, I thought so too, and it was probably around 85 to 90 most days. I think it got up to 95 one day, which was damn hot. It wasn't as unbearable as it's been at times when I've gone down there in the summer. We went down 1 year to go to the Austin City Limits Music Festival, and all I really remember from that festival is how unbearably hot it was. Got back here, and then yesterday, Wednesday, I performed at the first out to lunch event down at Karis Park. Karis Park is this beautiful park on the banks of the Clark Fork River in downtown Missoula. And every Wednesday in the summer, they have this event called Out to Lunch, where a bunch of food vendors come down, and everybody comes down and sits around and eats and listens to live music. And in this case, that live music was me and some other people, which was a strange first in many ways for me, because it was the biggest like rock and roll performance in terms of audience size that I've ever played before. There were thousands of people who came through, and you know, seemed like a fair number of them at least took a glance at the stage. Oh yeah, it's a huge event. I mean, not tens of thousands, but probably 2,000 or 3,000 people easily.
That's awesome. You were beating the skins, as they say.
Yes, exactly. I was masturbating. Playing the drums. Yes. I was playing with this band. With this woman named Andrea Harsell, who's a local singer-songwriter who has been recording an album, and I put down some drum parts on the album, and in so doing sort of got enlisted in the band. And the great irony of this performance, you know, this biggest rock performance of my life, was that it was playing in the most unrehearsed band I've ever been in. Playing a type of music that I usually claim to detest.
Well, what kind of music is that?
The blues.
Ah.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't straight blues by any stretch of the imagination. It was a lot of kind of rockabilly and some sort of country-ish stuff and general rootsy Americana type stuff. But there was definitely some fairly straightforward blues stuff. We played the Fishing Song, which is, some famous old blues guy, and did a Bonnie Raitt song and this kind of stuff. And the thing that I've always felt about the blues is that it's it's a kind of music that you hear a lot, largely because it's easy to play with minimal rehearsal, and even sometimes with minimal skill. And those things applied certainly in this instance on my part. You know, Andrea is a fantastic singer, but I wouldn't have been able to play a show of particularly complicated music with so little rehearsals. I think we only had three rehearsals together, and actually only one rehearsal as a whole band before this three-hour performance. So.
You know, it's funny, Jay, that you, of course, are a percussionist, a drummer of some, well, I believe anyway that you probably have some skill.
I think.
But the funny thing is that in all the time that we've hung out together, I really haven't heard you play much at all.
Yeah, well, we became friends shortly after I had my bad breakup with music and sold, you know, back in Indiana, back in when I quit the music school. I sort of felt like, you know, without staying, you know, loose and limber and in shape musically, it was just always frustrating to play. So in
You felt like there was just no point if you weren't going to be at the top of your game.
Why do it? Yeah. So I sold not only my drum set, but even all of my sticks and timpani mallets and even my sheet music. And just got out of it all together. And that's something that I regret now, although I kind of understand why I did it that way. But
yeah. So you have a drum kit now, I take it?
Yeah. Yeah, I have a much better drum kit, so maybe that was the one sort of fringe benefit, was that since I waited so long to finally get back into it, I finally, when I did do it, I had enough money to buy a half-decent set, which I didn't have before.
That's awesome. Now, this may seem like a bit of a tangent, but it all comes together eventually, I think. I've been recently going through my stockpile of old cassette tapes, the ones that survived Katrina and the floods of 2005, the ones that I still have, and I've been digitizing them pretty methodically, and of course I got a number of these cassette tapes, the more interesting ones, because of rocks and the music. You know, we were asking regularly, hey, you got any music? Give it to us, and So I've got some, you know, cassettes that are pretty obscure and that not a whole lot of people have heard, and I'm digitizing them. Anyway, probably one of the most obscure, at least most mysterious ones, is one that turned up at Daisy Brain Media Collective at one point. This would be back in the early 90s. And it was unlabeled, I guess. The only label that's on it now is it says Thumb Drumming.
S-O-M-E?
S-O-M-E, yes, just Thumb Drumming. And I recognize my handwriting on that label. I wrote that label myself. So, and I have no idea what this music is. I just labeled it Thumb Drumming because that's what's on it. It's like an impact of somebody drumming, and you know what? It's pretty good.
Well,
considering the fact that it's just drums, and you know, like just one guy presumably working out on the drums, there's still, you know, ideas that are worked through and advanced and so forth, and I really like it a lot. And then as a special bonus, at the end of the 10th track, or whatever it is, the last track, after you think it's all just drums, and then there's a little vocal track that comes on of a group of people apparently sitting around and chanting, "Fuck you," in a really kind of creative way, and it kind of comes to a climax and so forth. And I'm just like, you know, this is awesome. It's awesome because it's good. But also because it's so obscure and so weird that you feel like, you know, I feel like when I'm listening to it that I'm listening to something mysterious and just super cool.
Yeah.
So, So that, of course, leads me to think about something that we were talking about recently on one of our previous conversations, Zamboni and the music blogging scene and all of that stuff. You remember Zamboni, right? The Zamboni blog?
Yeah, right.
Well, guess what? It turns out that the guy who does that blog is from Bloomington and he's a huge Rocks fan.
Oh my God. That's insane.
Isn't that kind of weird?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea whatsoever that this was this connection. Now, he's, a decade younger than us. But he used to hang out at rhinos and stuff like that, and as he was growing up, he was kind of mildly obsessed with rocks, but in a non-creepy way, as he put it. So he and I have been exchanging emails and music.
Over the last couple weeks.
And that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's a tiny world.
It is a tiny world. In fact, you may remember that back in 1994, when we made that TV show about smoking marijuana.
Oh, I remember that one.
Yes, that Howard Stern featured a clip of that show on his radio program. And we never got to hear it. We were told we never heard it. But we did know that it was the case because we figured out how he got it in the first place. I mean, this is based on your log that you kept of all our media contacts at that time. We figured out how he got it. And it also led to us, because somebody at MTV heard it. That little feature on Howard Stern led to us being included in the Straight Dope special on MTV. So it led to much fame, although not a whole lot of fortune, much fame for you and I. And so we are both basically not electable as public officials because of Howard Stern. So anyway, this guy, the proprietor of the Zamboni blog, somehow or another, he has chased down the audio from that Howard Stern 1994 episode. And so this morning, I heard that clip for the first time.
Wow, that's just insane.
15 years after the fact.
And it's my blog now.
I don't suppose you've had a chance to listen to it.
I actually did, but I'm feigning surprise at this point, just for the dramatic purposes of this conversation.
Well, should we include it for listeners to this podcast?
Go, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we'll insert that here.
So anyway, I think it's Bloomington, Indiana, two guys got on a public access cable show that they call J&B on the Rocks.
Cool.
To promote the use of marijuana.
Cool.
Joe Nickel and Bart Everson started this show. Here's the opening of the show, Tykehart 5.
All right, here is the opening
of this new show, J&B on the Rocks.
Okay, let's hear it. Sounds like Arsenio's show. This is the opening of the show for the marijuana show.
Yeah.
Here we go.
J&B on the Rocks.
Hello. Welcome to J&B on the Rocks. Rocks. Welcome to J&B on the Rocks. I'm Jay.
And I'm B.
And this is a joint.
This is a joint. And we're going to smoke it now. Joint endeavor here.
Oh, baby.
Good show, huh, Jackie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm going to write a show just like that.
Hey, maybe those guys need a writer.
And here's a little bit more of the show where they actually get educational.
It's time to load up a pipe. This is the next implement that we're going to be using tonight.
Like, we needed a show to learn this.
This is one of the many ways that you can smoke marijuana. Now, this is the kind of marijuana you would normally buy in Indiana.
Yeah, crummy pot.
Lots of seeds and stems.
Here's how you get rid of it.
You gotta really clean.
And then
you put
Indiana. A hydroponic garden in your parents' house. They don't know what it is anyway.
And a black light.
So you get yourself a little lid like this, and you roll the marijuana around, and you pick out the seeds and the stems, and
with
you let all the good stuff here down at the bottom.
I have pipes that are older than you, Robin.
You know, the seeds aren't good because when they get hot, they pop, so that's not good. You don't want that in your pipe.
They don't give you a buzz anyway.
Robin, why don't you talk to us about how you were stoned every day for a year?
Is that right? Did she tell you that?
Yeah. She sat on the floor of her apartment.
I think I know this stuff. You didn't say it to me. So anyway, let me see. What else is going on?
Stopped her from talking.
Yeah. As for my book, I don't give enough that information.
Go ahead, yeah. So what happened to these guys?
No, they just set Bloomington on its ear. It's gotten a lot of publicity for them out there because they started a marijuana show.
I see. Mm-hmm. Isn't that against the law to, like, smoke on TV? Don't you get arrested or something?
You know, it's strange to me what public access is all about. You seem to be able to do anything on public access.
Yeah, it's okay. There's all kinds of wacky rules.
There's networks, and then there's cable, and then there's this public access.
Should I put this out?
Seems to be no rules there.
Yeah.
So what did you think, then, of that little snippet of audio?
Well, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned in that blog post that that he made us sound even stupider than we made ourselves sound, which is a remarkable feat. You know, it's interesting to me how, the thing that strikes me, I've never been a Howard Stern listener, I have to admit, but the production quality and continuity and such of his own program seemed not really much greater than that of our program.
Well, which is, certainly has a much bigger, what do you call it, a trumpet? Much bigger.
Yeah, well, yeah, and paycheck and fame and
yeah.
You know, list of communicable diseases at this point, all of that. But, you know, it's so, you know, there, but for the
but I've heard it, it's that he has a way.
It's like that, wait, huh?
It's a well-known fact that he has a very small penis.
Oh, gotcha. Right on.
But that is neither here nor there. The main thing that I took away from that is that Howard Stern does have a fairly big audience, which surprises me, given the fact that it seems rather silly. I mean, did you see the movie that he made?
I did not, no.
Private Parts, was that the name of the movie? I mean, that was the name of his book, was Private Parts, but I think that was also the name of the movie. Well, I've got this pretty cool book, pretty cool movie. I haven't read the book.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie is pretty cool. Actually, I would say I'd recommend it. Watch it. I think you'd enjoy it. It's a great movie. Because it really paints a somewhat inspiring portrait of a guy who's, like, you know, gone out on a limb, First Amendment, and this kind of stuff, you know, free speech, freedom of speech,
yeah.
Which kind of we've been classified in that same realm of, you know, going out on a limb for the First Amendment and so forth. The reality of actually listening to a show is, of course, not, doesn't quite live up to the glamour and the, I don't know, you know, the appeal of that film, I don't think. But whatever. You know, probably the same could be said if you were to distill everything that we did with Rock down to an hour and a half movie.
Yeah.
The show itself might not hold up in some people's minds if you were to examine it, you know, minute by minute.
To
what you would, the general takeaway that you'd get from a short little shot. But that's what I regret, is that we haven't ever been able to distill it down to something cohesive like that. I don't know if we ever will get a chance to do that, or if we'll ever have the gumption to do that, but something worth considering.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I remember when we were trying to sort of push that show to the next level, which for us really at that point meant being able to have a professional facility and work full time solely on the creative aspect of it, and not have to worry about, you know, like fundraising for it essentially, which is what we were doing so much of, and having perhaps even like an assistant staff of editors to cull through the footage to at least find the stuff that was worth using before you edited it together and all that stuff. You know, these grand dreams we had of how it would become sort of a commercial quality program. And, you know, there were quite a number of cable networks that showed an interest in talking with us about the program. You know, they'd read something in some magazine about how the show was good, and so they'd contact us. You know, we were contacted by Comedy Central at one point, I recall, and even the most comically off base was when Nickelodeon contacted us.
You're gonna bring that up.
Yeah, and but you know, I remember trying to hearing feedback and also trying to explain to people that, you know, this is a show that's produced with no budget by two guys with no help, you know, barely scraping by, and on really sort of basic level equipment. And wouldn't it be amazing to see what it would be like if we had more resources to throw at it? And I think that, you know, that never really, I'm not sure if that pitch ever really works that well. You know, people want to, I think that it was it's hard for me to say.
I think it works well in other than in other industries. I think it works in, what do you call it, music and in film.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more than in television, because television is such a corporate media. Such, you know, the dynamic is just so different. You do get, I think the only, I mean, the only models that we could look to are Tom Green and Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure who else.
Even Mystery Science Theater, when it went to national distribution, suddenly they had multiple full-time writers, for example, you know, which we lacked. So it could be that simply the show, as it stood, wasn't good enough to even consider what it would be like if it, you know, had more resources.
Or maybe we're just no, Jay.
Oh, couldn't have been
never,
that, right?
Never ever say that. That is absolute anathema. No, that's absolutely not. You shouldn't doubt yourself at that level. In terms of the quality of programming that was produced by us, especially in the as we really got our chops, so to speak, which I would say from a technical standpoint was our third season. It was, I think, really quite amazing what we were able to pull off.
Sorry.
I think we did produce a series of documents of our time and place.
Mm-hmm.
But what we seemed to, I think, lack was the commitment to stick with it and stay poor for as long as necessary, or to move to the centers of cultural production in order to really make it happen.
That was the thing that I think really hamstrung us ultimately, it seemed, was we, you know, the sort of between the lines feedback that I always felt like I was getting was, well, who cares about Indiana? And you know, I can see that point, but frankly, as an Indianan at the time, my response to it was, well, yeah, and who cares about New York City too? I mean, they're places with character. but just because New York City has more people to it doesn't make it inherently more interesting.
Yeah, but we, I think we stayed true to our subcultural and countercultural, what do you call it, roots or spirit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's inherent in that proposition that you're not going to have a whole lot of economic viability in the mainstream culture.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would say that we were ahead of our time, even in ways that that went beyond the things that we produced. For example, you know, you recall the time when I was when we put together that fairly elaborate pitch to fraternities around the Indiana University campus that we would come and document their frat parties. And, you know, I mean, now there's a huge industry in well, at least, you know, frat party porn anyway.
Can you imagine if that had succeeded?
Yeah, I know. We'd be rich.
Yeah, but, I mean, talk about, I mean, that was certainly at a point at which we were quite desperate. And, and we were really thinking about prostituting ourselves. I mean, you know, one thing I'm proud of is actually the fact that we did not consider ourselves so avant-garde and so artsy that we would never even consider prostituting ourselves. Quite the opposite. We were more than interested in selling out, but we just couldn't figure out how to do so, and nobody else in the nobody in the industry could figure out how to sell us out. So we ended up, moving on to other things.
Right.
But I think that would have been extremely unfortunate if we had crashed our ship, so to speak, on those rocks.
Yeah.
Instead, we just figured out. And I think
crashed it on many other rocks.
And many others. You know, it should be noted that we spent an entire year, the year of 1996, not producing any shows at all, but just concentrating on the business aspect. How can we monetize this? How can we make a buck off of this? And, you know, obviously, we didn't figure that out in the long run, but we tried with the limited resources that we had in Bloomington, Indiana, which, of course, is not the optimal place for such things to be launched.
Yeah.
Again, the television industry is very corporate and very, very concentrated in L.A. and New York, I guess.
Yeah. Although I think it's that has changed somewhat as well, you know, with
sure, because
now
we were
that
the internet. I mean, we were the first TV show on the internet, as noted in another audio clip, which I recently posted as well. We were pre-internet, and the internet really has changed how we think and how we work in terms of cultural production, especially because you can think and you can write anywhere, right? And in the internet age, that's more true than ever.
Yeah.
You can collaborate on creative projects from anywhere, and you see that all the time. Yeah. Clearly. But on the other hand, I don't think that such a proposition as what we were doing would be as fresh and as interesting to that.
Oh, not at all. Yeah, I mean, it's so overdone at this point that, it doesn't hold nearly the...
Does the word mumblecore mean anything to you?
I don't know. What is that?
Mumblecore. It's supposedly a genre of video that's on the internet these days, YouTube and whatnot. People who make these little videos where you're like, they're kind of holding the camcorder up on themselves and mumbling about something. I guess that's why it's called mumblecore, because you can't quite hear what they're saying too well. Production values are very low, in other words. And, I mean, it just sounds, very similar to kind of stuff that we've been doing, and some people have had some success with that.
Yeah. Well, hats off to them.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I would say the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, like, now I'm living in Montana, and you're in Louisiana, and we're both kind of middle-aged guys with jobs and kids.
Yeah, although, of course, it was pointed out to me earlier at the cocktail party I was at that there was a guy there from Shreveport, and he was explaining to me that he was from this called Louisiana to the north.
Mm-hmm.
Which, is kind of alien state. But no, technically, you're absolutely correct. And the thing is that I don't exactly know where to go from here.
Yeah, you know, that's the crux of the question. We've been kind of addressing it in several of these conversations. You know, my own professional trajectory seems to be at a somewhat leveled off, you know,
level
state. I don't find that it's exactly where I wanted to end up, and I don't know, it sounds like you're fairly pleased with where you're at, but at the same time there are lingering questions, as it were.
Well, yeah, I'm pleased with where I'm at from a professional standpoint in terms of, you know, I just celebrated 10 years at this job. 10 years.
Wow.
At the same job. I never thought that I would log so many years at one institution and so forth. And I'm pretty, I'm pretty happy with that. But, and of course, what I do is largely involved with some creativity and so forth. But the expression of a kind of vision, if you will, or a take on things, that was something that we accomplished, of course, with our video project. Kind of an underlying motive, kind of an underlying driving force for most musicians, writers, painters, whatever, is to express that. That vision, that view of the world. And I had for long before I ever got involved in video production, I thought that I was the ultimate thing, so I would like to express this in some kind of writing, in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that is still a dream that I have.
Yeah, me too.
Hard to actually realize.
Yeah. Maybe we should have a race.
Okay, yeah, you're on.
You've already got me beat, I'm afraid. I don't know. It's funny because that, you know, I think I've mentioned before that the whole reason I got into journalism was out of some kind of self, self-deduced and ultimately incorrect assumption that if I did journalism, I would develop writing skills, which that part was absolutely correct, but then also that I would somehow gain contacts in the writing industry, which would help me work into the novel writing industry, which, of course, is that part was just ludicrously off base. I mean, you know, you're just as likely to get those contacts as a plumber.
Sure, and, of course, novel writing industry is something of a misnomer in itself, I would imagine. It is a question. I mean, I've got to say that although the fantasy of sustaining myself as a writer is very entrancing, I would be just as interested in a completely non-commercially successful, but artistically successful venture into the realms of fiction. but I find myself somewhat stymied by my own life. And by that I mean, of course, as you can imagine, well, yes, there's demands of work and family and caring for young children and so forth, and that takes a lot of time. So there's always the question of where you're going to find the time to do right and so forth. But beyond that, I think the real crux of the matter is thinking in terms of conventionally, it seems like fiction is structured around, well, characters and plot lines. And yeah, my mind just doesn't seem to go that way.
Where does your mind go?
Well, settings, certainly concepts, metaphors, and stylistic conceit. But character is something I have a real problem with. Yeah.
Is it something that you you mean in the sense that you don't necessarily think of them yourself? Can't really put clarity to who these characters can be?
Yeah, I mean, I don't care, I think, enough about people. Although I think of myself as a compassionate, you know, humanist, and so forth. I still find that sometimes I down to it. You know, I actually for many years thought of myself as a deep misanthrope. And I think that part of that, I think there's something to that, even after all this time, even though I've mellowed with age and so forth, that I can consider the individuals that I know in my life, in my real life, and love them. But when I try to imagine people, I don't really imagine people. I mean, I'm not interested in sitting around and imagining people and the
situations
that they might get into. Which isn't to say that I don't think I could structure some kind of interesting fictional narrative. Because I think if I try hard enough and long enough and so forth, I might be able to. But I don't think it will be a typical character-driven narrative that you might imagine.
Yeah.
It's something a little bit different, perhaps a little stylistic. You know. But I think what's interesting about that process is what it reveals to me about myself. I mean, for me, that's I think, the most interesting part. I don't know if that makes it interesting for anybody else. To read, I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would certainly be one who is interested in seeing what would come of it.
Well, thank you for that vote of confidence.
Sure thing.
I've had a number of efforts underway over the years, and they run afoul of different things. I was making, I felt like, pretty good progress on my first attempt at a novel in years when September 11th hit.
Paris.
Yeah. All of a sudden, that just seemed like the silliest damn thing to spend one's time on. And so it kind of took the wind out of my sails, if you will. And lately, I've engaged in different efforts to churn, just generate volume. And of course, that has the predictable result of a lot of crap.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but you know, there's value in churning crap.
Yeah, it's good practice.
Well, I guess I wish that I had advice, but of course, I stumble on many of the same or similar issues myself. I mean, you know, particularly the life getting in the way part of it. Because I just don't know when I would write a novel.
Well, that's a fair point. And what I always look to is Gene Wolfe, the author of The Book of the New Sun, my favorite book of all time I've ever read. And I've read it many times, and I'm just a great admirer. He wrote that, and he would get up early in the morning, and before he went to work, he would spend a couple hours on writing. And in that little bit of the day that he had set aside for himself, he created a huge, monstrous masterwork. Look at this. I have a poster strudel.
A poster strudel?
My loving wife. Yeah.
Well, there you go. You know, the problem, I've always thought, well, I should just get up earlier and work on that novel. But, of course, getting up earlier does generally require going to sleep earlier as well. And that's the thing that often trips me up.
Obviously, you just need to get by on less sleep.
Right, exactly, or none.
But right now you have a very young child, and so that might not be an option. I mean, generally speaking, the hackneyed trope is that parents of young children are sleep deprived. And I know that's the case here. We're not only getting up several times in the night, often tending to our girls' little needs. And so we are definitely running on less sleep than we've had in the past. But look at all the time that it's not like we've had kids young. There's plenty of time to write novels in the past, and we didn't get time to set up. I'm not really sure I buy that excuse. And also, I think that although the novel is a very seductive form to aim for, short fiction is certainly worth considering first.
Just write something and see where it leads. And the most powerful thing I've ever read was a piece of short fiction. Like a 30-page story, I believe it was.
And Kafka embedded in his narrative some very short parables, only a page or two.
Which are, I think, amongst the greatest things ever written. Wow. Yeah, and of course, there's the story of Tom Bombadil in Lord of the Rings, which is essentially a sort of side novel. Side story.
It sure is. Although that's a great example. And the commercial viability of any of those examples has to be questioned.
I guess I don't have much to say on those matters other than I do hold out hope against hope that the time will come when I can find time for such endeavors. Right now, for example, the work that I have to do tonight, it's work that I enjoy. I would be, in this instance, I would be doing it whether or not it was financially necessary. But the fact is that right now I'm in a financial state where any, you know, short-term guaranteed money opportunities that aren't too detestable to me, I have to take them.
Sure. And I know from the kind of writing that you're doing and the venues that you're writing for, that it certainly tends to feel ephemeral. The writing that you're doing is, you know, it's here and it's read. It's read by more people than a lot of writers ever get read by.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gone tomorrow. And,
yep.
You know, what does it all add up to? It doesn't seem to accumulate or add up to a more substantial body of work. And, I mean, I absolutely understand that aspect of it and don't know what the answer is. But it seems like one thing that we share in common is the feeling that in the early 90s with this program Rocks that we collaborated on, that we achieved a kind of artistic, I wouldn't want to say peak example because of the implications that would have that we could never, you know.
It's all downhill from here.
All downhill, exactly. Yeah. But rather a level of achievement that showed us, to some extent, how powerful this kind of expression can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got a taste of it, if you will, and
yeah.
Thought, you know what, this is pretty cool. And we'd like some more, but we're just not sure how to do that.
Right.
Kind of snuck up.
And of course, we've let our youth slip away, so we don't have the edgy young artist appeal anymore. So now we have to battle it out for edgy middle-aged artist or something.
yes, perhaps. So maybe some of the audacity. I thought that's what you're going to say is that we might not have the level of audacity that we had back then.
Right, yeah. That too.
But, you know, we were fairly fortunate and fairly privileged to be able to have that level of audacity to begin with.
Right.
Well, it has been very nice to have this conversation with you a little bit earlier than we have sometimes in the past because, you know, our time differential is such.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's a little late for me, and I don't really quite feel like all my pistons are firing anymore.
Uh-huh.
But I felt a little bit more cogent for this discussion.
Yeah.
And, of course, you are, you know, maintaining your sobriety so that you can keep going for the work that you have to do later tonight. So perhaps someday we'll look back upon this conversation as a brief moment of clarity in an otherwise rather disorganized and confusing dialogue.
Well, hopefully so. That would be a good aim. Now, you know, we just need to, like, get off our asses and do something about it.
Yeah, you mean recording these podcasts is not sufficient?
Oh, yes, it is, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. Well, it's good talking to you, and I will, I guess we'll be talking next week.
Yes, and until next time, I remain your faithful servant.
And I yours.
Bye.